This is CD 15 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains part 1 of session number 13 titled Dying.
Tonight we are going to reflect together about the matter of death. The Gita reiterates in a number of places certain repetitive ideas about what it is that dies or doesn't die and what illusion we're caught in. And for many of us, we read this stuff and it's... Since it costs to get in here, there are a lot of people who stay outside through these lectures because they don't have the money, or it's against their principles to give the money, or one reason or another. And I've often thought that sometimes it's more interesting outside than inside. And it reminds me of the... I was at the Newport Jazz Festival, and Timothy had given me this stuff. He said was... he said it was something new and beautiful, and... So we all took some. We all took some, and I was with Maynard and Flo Ferguson. He's a jazz trumpeter. And Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond. So we all took some, and I was left holding the bottle, and I didn't know what they were. And after about a half an hour, nothing had happened, and I decided Tim was putting me on. So I kept eating them sort of like mints, but they turned out to be mescaline, and it was very slow acting. So I, when it finally did... happened that my consciousness was altered. I was wandering around backstage with the musicians where I felt very much in because I was with the musicians. And there was a huge canvas that kept the audience in or out. And I was walking around by the canvas and I looked in. I came to a little hole and I opened it and looked in. And there was somebody looking back at me. And he said to me, hey, do you want to get in? At the time, it seemed profound. This shows you. And what I was saying about the Gita was that you can read these lines about death in the Gita, but for most of us, we still push pretty hard to keep death away. If there's anything that is really a panic trip for most human beings, for most entities, it is the loss of their entityness as they know it to be. And survival is the root anxiety or fear. And so we talk a lot about death sort of academically, but we're not overly eager to bring it too close. And because I think at this point it gets very much personal in the sense of our own awakenings to our feelings about death. I'd like to share with you a series of experiences that have led to a change in my perception of death. And then we would like to take you through a series of slides of death and a series of meditation exercises and quotes and just rapping about these slides. Now, this is the first time we've attempted to do this, and we've only brought the slides together in the past few weeks, and even collecting the slides has been quite an extraordinary education for us, because as anxious as we may still be, it's nothing like the people from whom we were trying to collect them from, which were people like the county coroner, the state police, the cancer society, the medical school. But we have put together some slides which I think will give you a chance to explore your own feelings in relation to death, because I think there's a point where it's interesting to stop just thinking about it and feel about it as well. The Gita says, as the dweller in the body experiences in the body childhood, youth, old age, so passes he on to another body. The steadfast one does not grieve at that. He who regards death as a slayer, or he who thinks he is slain, both of them are ignorant. He slays not, nor is he slain. He is not born, nor does he die, nor having been, ceases he any more to be. Unborn, perpetual, eternal and ancient, he is not slain when the body is slaughtered or dies. And then, as a man casting off worn-out garments gets new ones, so the dweller in the body casting off worn-out bodies enters into others that are new. Weapons kill him not, nor fire burns, nor water wets him, nor wind dries him. Unkillable he, uncombustible he, neither to be wetted nor dried, perpetual, all-pervasive, stable, immovable, ancient. Unmanifest, unthinkable, unchangeable, he is called. Therefore, knowing him as such, you should not grieve. Or if you think of him as being constantly born and constantly dying, even then you should not grieve. For certain is death for the born, and certain is birth for the dead. Over the inevitable, you should not grieve. Now, those are the basic position the Gita takes. And people have been reading the Gita for years and maintaining incredible fear of death. Now, as a psychologist, because I was very much attached to the personality and to the body as being real, as far as I was concerned, in 1960, when you died, you were dead. And since when you died, you were dead. When somebody else died, they were dead, and you ought to have a grief reaction, and if you didn't, you were suspect. And for me, the game of life was to be optimally happy at every moment. And since death didn't seem to have much to do with happiness, death was to be denied or avoided. Since as a psychologist, I wouldn't say denied, I would say realistically coped with. Then I started taking psychedelics, and in the course of my experiences with psychedelics, I had a number of experiences in which I ceased to be as I knew myself to be and then re-entered. I think most of you are familiar from Be Here Now with my initial experience with psilocybin when I sat across the room from myself, 8 feet away, this being over there, and I saw this being become all my social roles. First a professor, and a pilot, and a cellist, and a lover, and an achiever, and so on. And each one I let go of, and let go of, and let go of, because I had to let go of it since I was on the couch and the being was over there. And then, as you probably recall, the one I saw over there in the semi-darkness of Tim's house that morning was whoever Richard was from when I was a child, when my parents started to label this entity as he's a good boy or he's a bad boy or whatever, whoever Richard was. There was Richardness over there. And when I saw that one, I thought I would have amnesia if I gave that one up. And then I thought, well, that's okay because I still have my body. But as you recall from reading that, that was a premature conclusion. Because as I looked down at the couch I was sitting on, I saw nothing below my knees. And then to my horror, I looked with eyes open and saw the entire couch and there was no body on it. Now, there was nothing in my psychological training that prepared me for that perceptual experience. And I was about to freak and yell for Tim and bad trip it, as you might say, when I suddenly thought in my Jewish humor mind, but who's minding the store? Like, who is it that's about to scream? If everybody you thought you were, including your body, isn't, who's screaming? Who's freaked? Who is this? Who is it? And suddenly all the anxiety was gone, and I felt like I had met a new being in myself that wasn't connected with who I thought I was. So who I thought I was suddenly started to lose its power to scare me, so that when I lost my professorship, I was just losing professorshipness. And it was easier when I lost my hair. You know, it wasn't like I was losing my hair. It was like, look at that, go. Because my identity was less connected with body, with personality, with social roles. Now, along about that time, we were working with Aldous Huxley, who was then a visiting professor at MIT. And Aldous, or Gerald Hurd, I don't quite remember which one, introduced us to the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead was quite extraordinary. It was a book used by lamas to read to other lamas at the time of their death and for 49 days thereafter. And it concerned the bardos, or states, which can be understood both as states or planes of reality that one goes through as one leaves this plane, or you can see it at another level as existing right here. All of the bardos are here, and Chogyam Trungpa talks about the bardo states as being right here also. But the thing that was quite extraordinary for me was that in reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, I was coming across experiences, descriptions of state, bardo states, that were like reading something and saying, my God, that's what happened to me last Thursday night. Okay. Now, that was pretty weird to have a book that was 2,500 years old describing the things that we were looking at each other and saying, it's indescribable, it's ineffable. And here it was all printed and choreographed already for 2,500 years. So we were talking, we took the Tibetan Book of the Dead and did Tim and Ralph mainly did a translation, a transformation of Evans Wendt's translation, and put it out as a book called The Psychedelic Experience, which we were treating as a metaphor for dying and being born through the use of psychedelics. We were interested in having manuals available for using psychedelics, so that it wasn't just either you took drugs because you were a crazy junkie or you were sick, which were the only existing models in our culture for the use of drugs. During these periods of time when we were experimenting with psychedelics, for example, we would run sessions, very carefully programmed sessions, where we would prepare tapes and one of us would guide and the rest of us would be guided through various sessions. And the sessions concerned sex and they concerned Western culture and they concerned philosophy and they concerned music and they concerned death. And there was one session that Timothy was guiding, which was we were using the Tao Te Ching, and there were a number of us lying on the floor of the meditation house. And there was a gal next to me who, as the chemical took effect, she became more and more passionate. And my body was next to hers, so the passion was directed towards my body. But an interesting thing had happened to me, because Timothy had read one of the Tao quotes, which had taken me to a point where I was up on the far corner of the ceiling, looking back down at this situation, and there was this long, blue, luminous cord that appeared to come from wherever I was back to this inert body that was lying on the floor, which was being made love to by this girl. And there was something in me that wanted to tell her that she was making love to like a dead body. But there was no possibility of communication, because where I was, it didn't seem to be relevant. Now, that began a series of what are called out-of-body experiences for me, which were very frequent during the times of psychedelics, and then disappeared for a long time and reappeared after being given a mantra by Swami Muktananda and doing this mantra in a very intense environment where I again left my body and was astrally flying. Now, you can imagine how leaving your body these ways in terms of sensory experiences affects your feeling about what's going to die. About this time, my mother was dying of spleen condition. And I began to spend a great deal of time at the hospital with her. And I would come to the hospital stoned on this or that, and she would be being kept together from her pain, being stoned on this or that, although she wouldn't call it that. The doctors were treating her was the way they said it. And we would sit together, And we would have moments of incredible presence. And as we sat in this hospital room together, people would come into the room, nurses, my father, relatives, my aunts and uncles, and they would all be involved in a very obviously totally hysterical denial of what was happening. And then they'd walk out in the hall and say, you know, she won't live the week. And I was just sitting in the room, just meditating, being quiet with her, holding her hand. And at one point when she and I were alone in the room, she said, Rich, she said, you know I'm going to die. But she said, nobody will talk to me about it. So I said, yeah, I think you are going to leave your body. She says, what do you think's going to happen? I said, well, you know, I don't know. But I said, there's one thing, it's interesting. You know, your body has been decaying, but somehow you and I still seem to be in pretty good contact. I don't see that you're still who I know you to be, and I'm who you know me to be, and here we are, and all this decay is going on. And from what I've read and what I've felt, I have a suspicion that when you drop your body, it's all going to continue to be the same thing. That really not a hell of a lot's going to happen. There'll be some confusion, but it's all going to be apparently all right. And I guess I was pretty much horrified by the environment of denial that surrounded her during that time. When she died, I went to the funeral and I took LSD to go to the funeral, which was interesting because she was at the funeral also, of course. And she and I were together, and it was really quite beautiful, and we enjoyed all of the loving people coming together, and it was a very happy occasion for both of us. I was put in a rather peculiar position because it was a big funeral, and they, according to showbiz, they put the mourners of the family on one side of the casket and then all the others on the other so they can look at the mourners mourning. And I realized that one smile, you know, and that would be it, would be, you know. He's the one that takes drugs, wouldn't you know? Laughs at his own mother's funeral. So isn't that the height of the most horrible thing you can imagine? There's another thing about that funeral that interests me. And this story, since you might say, well, you were under acid, I'm reporting to you as it comes through my family, not through me. I saw it, but you wouldn't believe me. We were in the temple, and the casket, you've got to understand that my mother and father exchanged every anniversary, in addition to gifts, they exchanged one red rose, which was a token of their continuing love for one another. And they had been married 44 years. And the coffin was covered with a blanket of roses. And as the coffin was being wheeled down the aisle, it passed by the row in which sat my father, my oldest brother, who was a stockbroker in New York, his wife, who was a Long Island wife of a stockbroker in New York. Another brother who at the time was under the delusion that he was Christ. And me. My father's a very conservative Boston attorney, ex-president of a railroad. As the coffin went by the row, one rose fell off the blanket and fell at my father's feet. We all looked at the rose. We all knew the story. And as the group adjourned, my father reached down and he picked up the rose and we all went out and got in the Cadillac, you know, the limousine to go to, and everybody was coming up to the window to share our grief. And he was holding the rose and nobody was saying a word. Finally, my brother, Christ, he said, well, I guess she sent you a message. And everybody in the car agreed. Imagine that. They all said, yes, right. Now, there was a beautiful moment in which the emotion of the moment had led everybody to transcend all their cynicism and allow for the possibility that this had actually happened, that a message had come, quote, from the beyond. The next question my father raised was, how will we preserve it? Because he's a materialist, right? So that started a hysterical plan of action, which ended up finding a process where you could encase it in a plastic bubble of some kind of liquid so we for eternity could have this rose on the mantelpiece. Well, the years passed, and the procedure for preserving the rose wasn't foolproof, so that the water got all black and the rose got all deadish. So on the mantelpiece was this deadish, blackish water, sort of brackish water. And it came time for my father, after a proper time, to marry again a very wonderful woman. I gave the bride away. And there was some question as to what to do with this eternal memento, right? That's the whole thing of preserving it for eternity, that clinging. So it now resides in a closet set aside for things that we are preserving eternally, okay? Just one more memory of her death. I remember visiting her, and she had had infection in her lower gums, so they had removed the teeth, so her bridge didn't fit anymore, so she couldn't have her teeth in. And it had turned out that in all the years I'd known her, I had never been allowed to see her without her teeth. And here she was at the point of dying, within 2 days of dying, and she was holding a fan with her last bit of energy, holding a fan up to her mouth, lest her son should see her without her teeth. I mean, I want you to deal with these little issues because they're all part of our ways of dealing with dying and the decay of the body in relation to dying. Now I went to India and I met Maharaji. And Maharaji said to me the day I met him, he said, you were thinking about your mother last night. I said, yeah. See, she had appeared to me twice, or rather one very clear time, in Nepal on the ceiling of the hotel. I was trying to decide whether to go back into India and go with Bhagwan Das and go and do temple pilgrimages or go on to Japan. And I was, the India thing meant I'd be without money and it would be kind of nitty-gritty and it would be wild. And Japan was so secure and first class. And I wasn't sure because India was really a divergence from my triptych. And finally, I was sitting there thinking I'd go back to India, and my mother appeared, and she looked at me with a look which looked both a combination she had of looking peeved and pleased at the same moment. Because the middle-class woman was peeved, saying, why don't you settle down and do it? You've blown Harvard, you've blown this, why don't you settle down and be a responsible member of the community? And the other part of her was saying, go, baby, go. See? That little part of her, this little other part of her. Now, that little part that was saying, go, baby, go, I just suspected was in there, but I was so used to dealing with a middle-class woman that all of the Freudian things about mothers were totally applicable to me and her. So when I came to my guru and he said, your mother died last year, and he told me how she died, he closed his eyes and he said, she got very big in the stomach before she died, which is true, her spleen enlarged. I said, yes. And then he said, spleen. He said the way in which he died. And that was a very profound impact on me. The next day he said to me, you know, he said, your mother is a very high being. So I said to whoever was translating at that time, didn't he say she was a very high being? And he asked Maharaj Gimar, nay, she is a very high being. And suddenly the whole figure ground reversal occurred. And I saw this high being who had taken incarnation as this middle-class Jewish woman from Boston, who had been my karma through this round, and who had been there in some subtle way supporting my going out and out and out and out, or on and on and on, or under and under and under, depending on which way you're looking at it, right? At the same moment, keeping up this veneer of total so middle class, in fact, fooling herself most of the time. And in a way, I began to re-perceive her. In other words, what I'm saying is sometimes when somebody has died out from under you before you finished your work with them, the work keeps going on until you cleared yourself enough or put yourself in the right position to see who in fact they were, not who you thought they were all the way along, because these are figure ground problems. Maharaji spoke quite a bit about death. He told a number of people things like the body dies but not the soul. The real man doesn't die. That the body passes away, everything is impermanent except the love of God. That you can't take anything with you when you die. The world is just a dream, an illusion. I told you the story already where he was walking with a man and he said, Maharaji said, so and so, this old woman devotee just died. And then Maharaji laughed and the man said, you butcher, what are you laughing about if she just died? And Maharaji said, do you want me to act like one of the dolls? You want me to make believe I'm sad? Because in fact, she'd finished her work and she had just left. And from his point of view, since he sees outside of time, okay, fine. At one point, Maharaji was sitting there and he said, somebody's here. And they said, no, Maharaji, nobody's here. And yes, somebody's just come. And it was a man who came. As a man came towards Maharaji, Maharaji yelled at him, I won't go. I won't go. I know so-and-so's dying, but I'm not going to go. The man said, how did you know, Maharaji? Nobody in the family knows, but he's dying and he called for you. And Maharaji says, nobody thinks I know anything. And he said, but I'm not going to go. He was an old devotee for years. And Maharaji says, he's suffering a lot, but I'm not going to go. Finally, Maharaji said, here, give him this banana. Then he'll be all right. And the man thanked him and pranamed and ran home with the banana, and they mashed it up and they put it between his lips, and he ate the banana and he died. Now, when I went to India in 67, I was still in my Land Rover phase, which was canned tuna fish and Land Rover and Vivaldi concertos and the tape recorder and first-class English-type hotels and keeping the windows closed so the germs wouldn't get in, and especially chlorinated water and so on. And I came to Benares, and we stayed at a hotel, and I went out on the street in Benares. I must admit I had taken a little LSD. Well, I like to be open to situations. And I went out on the street in Benares. Now, Benares is the city of dying in India. It is the place where people come to die, where when they die, they are burned at the burning ghats, these places by the river, by the Ganges, which are out over the river a little bit, where fires have been going for forever, and where the bodies are brought to be burned. And at the time when they're being burned, Shiva whispers the name of Ram into the ear of the person that's dying, and it brings about enlightenment. So that if you are living in that reality, Benares is a very, very auspicious place to die. I mean, once you understand what the game is about, like if you understand the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the Bardo Thodol and the whole idea of what you're thinking about at the last moment and not being attached, and about rebirth, the whole idea that you could, at the moment of death and being burned, be in the arms of God and go into it, that's exactly what the Gita says. At the time of death, think of me. Right? So it's a total fulfillment of the Gita's injunction. And as I walked around the streets of Benares, there were all these beings who were down to literally skin and bone, and many of them had leprosy or other rather horrific type of diseases, dragging themselves around with their begging bowls, hundreds and hundreds of them. And they had a loincloth on often, and they'd have a little pouch in it with just enough money for the wood for their funeral fire. Now, when you're walking around the street and you've just had a big meal at a nice fancy restaurant with an ice cream parfait, and you've got your traveler's checks in your pocket, and you're out to see the sights of Benares, see? And you're on acid, and you walk down the streets near the ghats to maybe take a picture or two. Right? And there are all these beings around, you know? And it's pretty good. You can keep them as them. Isn't this quaint? You know? But if by chance you look into somebody's eyes, the predicament is they're looking right back at you. And they're right here. And as I walked around, I got more and more discomforted, because I was feeling such incredible pity for these people. And the idea that I was holding traveler's checks and they were there was just, I couldn't stand it. And I actually literally went back and hid under the bed in the hotel. It was just too much for me. I couldn't stand it. It was too much. Right? Not just enough, but too much. It was not many months later when I had been with Maharaji and I had been now opened to the possibilities and began to understand what Benares was about, that I went back to Benares, and I walked by the ghats. I spent the whole night standing in the middle of a burning ghat where the bodies were burning all around me, and the smoke and the smell of flesh, and seeing the skulls cracked with a stick, and watching this whole process and just being part of it was going on. And all I felt when I was walking with these beings who were dragging around the streets, when I looked at them, I suddenly realized that they were feeling pity for me, because they had made it. And the likelihood of my making it was very slim. Look at me, rushing around, not knowing where I was, disoriented, not totally a cultural misfit. And the shoe was totally on the other foot, and I felt a sudden understanding of what the joy of this scene was. Once I got through my tough toilet training middle class thing about what bodies are supposed to look like and what suffering must be. Can you hear that issue? It was also in the temple in India that I first read the New Testament. And I labored long about the different ways in which Christ was supposed to have died and the implications of that. And it became clearer and clearer to me that what Christ was saying to everybody was, look, you're worried? Go ahead, I'll run through it for you so you won't be afraid. I'll do it for you. Okay? I'll take your suffering, even the suffering of the final doubt, like Abba, Abba, Father, Father, why have you forsaken me? I'll take it all on for you. And then I'll go and I'll die and I'll show you that it's no big deal because I'll drop back just to let you know it's cool. Right? And I began to see the power of that teaching in liberating you when you were ready to hear it, other than just getting into, oh, poor Christ hanging there on the cross. Because you began to see that when he was on the cross, like, it was perfectly cool with him. And I think when he said, forgive them, they know not what, he was just worried about the karma that was being accrued by all these people who were busy hating him. Then I met the writings of Ramana Maharshi, who was a very great saint in India, and I told you about this, that when Ramana Maharshi was dying and he had cancer of the arm and they said, heal yourself, he said, no, this body's done, and they said, don't leave us, and all the devotees started to weep, and he looked at them and he said, don't be silly, where can I go? Where could I possibly go? I'm here, where do you think I'm going? Just the body that's going, don't get so freaked. Well, I started to talk more and more about death from about 1965 or so on, because I felt that we were really doing a job on ourselves about death, because the drugs had certainly changed my perspective. And it's interesting that a doctoral dissertation, if you would like to know how doctoral dissertations confirm that which you already knew anyway, a doctoral dissertation was completed this year at the University of California, Berkeley, which demonstrates that people who have taken psychedelics or the people who have meditated for more than 3 years are significantly different from any other subculture in the population regarding their anxiety about dying. That they have less anxiety about dying than anybody else in the whole society, including undertakers. So when I came back to America these times, I started to get involved a little bit with dying, studying it, being around it. There was a gal, a friend of mine, Debbie Matheson, she died at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. See, hospitals are designed to keep people alive, and so it's a tricky place to die in because you're a failure to the system when you die. So you must be put under wraps because the whole system is based on keeping you alive by whatever means conceivably possible. She was part of the Zendo. And all of the fellow students decided that instead of meditating every evening at the Zendo, they'd come and meditate at her hospital room. So they came into Mount Sinai Hospital, the fancy pavilion, and pretty soon the room had been converted into a temple. It had a little puja shrine, and these beings would sit on the walls in their black robes, aligning the walls, just doing zazen. And the first evening this happened, the young residents pushed open the door to walk in with their hale, hearty, well, how are we doing tonight, you know, and let's see your chart, and you've been a good girl, did you eat all your, you know, that kind of place. And they walked into this temple, and they got, well, how are we do, see? And they realized the inappropriateness of their behavior. They were nice guys, and they stopped, and by the third night, instead of charging in, they were very gently opening the door and coming in and standing quietly for a few minutes looking at the chart and leaving. They were doing their work. They were like doctors on a football team now. They don't call the plays. They are merely there to help you if you break a leg. They are servants of the system rather than masters of it. Because the problem is doctors are generally, actually, higher in anxiety about death than the general population. So it's hardly somebody you want to die around. Now that showed me the possibility that somebody could die right in the middle of my, you know, right in the middle of the system. At one point, Wavy Gravy called me up. I'm sure many of you know him. He's a very beautiful spiritual entity in the scene in America. Wavy called me up and he said there was a young fellow dying and he knew I was interested in being with people who were dying. This fellow would like to talk to me. So I went over and I met this young fellow who was 23. I went over and I sat down next to him and I said, I hear you're going to die soon. He said, yeah. You want to talk about it? Okay. So we started to talk about it and we talked about how he was planning to die. He was planning to take acid and overdose and OD on heroin. because he wanted to go out free. He didn't want to go out in a hospital, and he had Hodgkin's disease. And he was in stage 4B, which is the terminal stage. And he had been through all the medical treatments, and he decided to go on it on his own. In order to avoid the pain, he had become a junkie in the past 6 months, and he was planning to die. And I said, that sounds reasonable to me. You ought to plan it and prepare so that you don't get freaked by the drugs. You should work with them so you'll know how to do it. He said, when I get too weak to move around, I think that's when I'll do it. I said, whenever you choose, it's your death. So we were sitting talking about this, and he went to light a cigarette, and he started to shake. And I thought, what am I doing? You know, I'm coming onto him. He's the one that's dying, and I'm freaking him out. And I said, hey, man, am I freaking you? Because I don't want to do that. And he said, no, you don't understand. He said, I've been looking for the strength to die, and you're the first person that's come along that isn't so freaked in their vibration when we get near the thing that you're giving me that strength. And I'm just absolutely being, you know, I'm overwhelmed by it, right? He said, I feel like a child about it. So we started to hang out together. We actually did a movie together talking about his dying. And he was wearing, his head had been shaved for his medicine and stuff. So he was wearing a hippie wig, actually a long wig. He had been a pusher for many years. And so in the middle of the movie, I had him take off his wig, so it really blew the audience apart. You know? We did it out in Sutro Park. But at one time, we were driving a rental car I had over in Marin County on US 1, which is a very curvy road that has a great drop down to the ocean, those of you that know it. And we stopped for gas, and he said, say, could I drive? It'll probably be my last time to drive. That's a pretty heavy one, right? 23-year-old guy, you know, the investment in driving. And so I said, sure, man, of course. So he got behind the wheel, and he started to drive, and I suddenly realized he was too weak to turn the steering wheel. So we'd aim for the cliff. We were only going about 20 miles an hour, but we'd aim, and I'd slowly reach over, and I'd make believe I wasn't turning the wheel, and he'd make believe I wasn't. And I'd turn the wheel, and then we'd go another direction, and then I'd turn the wheel again, you know. And I was sitting sort of driving surreptitiously, and he said, I think I'll have a cigarette. And I suddenly saw that I was involved in a conspiracy to deny the present moment. That the anxiety was so deep of clinging to who he thought he was. And I said to him, hey man, you know, we're in a conspiracy here. Like at this point, you should be lying back and grooving, and I should be chauffeuring you around, and we just should relax into it instead of trying to hold on to the past. And at that moment, I told him the story about the strawberry, and you know, the man over the cliff reaching for the strawberry, and the statement, how sweet it tasted. I said, enjoy the strawberry of this moment. And that really taught me a great deal about how seductive that conspiracy is when you're around dying people to get involved in the denial process. There is a woman who has written a very interesting book about dying in America called, her name is Kubler-Ross, and she is describing the zeitgeist. She's describing how people now die in America. And she says the first stage they go through is denial and isolation. You tell somebody they're going to die, they deny it. No, not me. Because it's so inconsistent with who you thought you were. And then at that point, they pull away from other people because they get to hate everybody. Then the next stage that she notices in her studies of patients is anger. They get furious. Who's done this to me? Then the third stage is bargaining. They try to bargain to have it changed. If I'm good and take my medicine, that kind of strategy. Then when they see the bargaining isn't going to work, comes depression. And finally, after the depression comes acceptance. And Kubler-Ross talks about these different stages, and the acceptance is merely, okay, I'm going to die. Right. But since there isn't any structure about it, there is still the subtle clingings to, I am going to die. And when you begin to understand about reincarnation, you understand that the thought at the moment of death is the critical thought, and those thoughts that determine what happens next. And once you realize that death can happen at any moment, you get so that you start to get your head straight about what you're thinking from moment to moment. And the story I've told about Mahatma Gandhi walking out into his backyard, being shot 3 times, and he doesn't say, oof, or I've been shot, or anything. He just says, Ram, Ram. He dies. He's so ready that at the moment of the total unexpected, he just goes right towards God. He just, yeah, here I come. Whoa, look, no hands. They're free, right? Recently I sat with a woman in Los Angeles. Her name was Ginny Pfeiffer, and you're going to see a picture of her dead on the screen that Laura Huxley took of her the next day. She lived with Laura and Aldous for many years. And when Laura took this picture, in order to keep her mouth closed, she had to stick chewing gum in to keep the mouth together. Laura called me to tell me that Ginny just insisted on having chewing gum right at the end. There's a certain macabre humor between Laura and Ginny and I about this death, because we all went through it very much together. That Laura was with Ginny. Ginny died at home, and Laura and Ginny and the doctor, and sometimes me when I was there, would discuss how much feeding, intravenous feeding, how long Ginny wanted to continue to live. The doctor can't kill you, but the doctor doesn't have to keep you alive if you don't want to stay alive. That's up to you. And it was totally collaborative. Now, Ginny was an intellectual. She was part of the Ernest Hemingway crowd. And so she wasn't much of a mystic. She thought it was all kind of bullshit. So when I came to visit her the first time, she was still full of arguments. And she said to me, "What do you think about all this dying business?" And I told her, and she says, "I think it's crap." Okay, Ginny, I still love you. But then later, when I came back to visit her, she was very weak. And I just like to define this scene because it's a very critical scene in my understanding of the process. She was too weak for me to talk to her, and she was in great pain. She was she was dying of cancer of the nervous system, which is a very painful death. And she was writhing in pain on the bed, right? Just writhing, continuous writhing. And I came in and I sat down next to the bed, and I proceeded to meditate. And I didn't meditate by going away from her. I meditated with my eyes open, and I meditated on her decaying body. I did the Buddhist meditation on the decaying body. And I saw the pain, and I saw the decay, and instead of freaking behind my emotions, I let them be here and just stayed with it until I was with the decaying body. And it got very, very, very peaceful and deep in the room. And it was quite an extraordinary moment, and she turned to me. This was after about 20 minutes, and she said to me, "I feel so much peace." And all the time, her body was writhing in pain. And I began to appreciate that the pain was there, it didn't go away, but she had pulled herself out from being identified with that person who was in pain, which is something that people have been exploring quite recently. Stan Grof, who's a very dear friend, has been doing work with LSD and terminal cancer patients. Originally, Eric Kast was doing it at the University of Chicago, giving LSD to people who were dying. And like I remember reading in the World Medical News, a nurse saying, "Yes, I know I am dying of cancer, but look at the beauty of the universe." That moment, she had extricated herself from an identification with that which was dying, and she was identified with the universe, of which her death was just a part of it. And since dying after puberty and among things like child rearing and so on, giving birth, are the most profound things in our lives, we owe them the respect to work with them, to prepare for them, to deal with them consciously. It is said that a man who dies before he dies does not die when he dies. Or Confucius said, "One who sees the way in the morning can gladly die in the evening." Well, what all this has led to in my head is a program for what are called Centers for Dying. I'm trying to help us in this society introduce alternative metaphors for dying in America. And Stu Brand, who did the Whole Earth Catalog, and I've talked about it because he's interested in it too, and we decided that initially we just start up with a telephone line, which would be like dial-a-death, where you could dial if you were dying and you wanted to die consciously, and we would send somebody who wanted to work on themselves through being with somebody who was dying consciously. There are no professional dyers, you know. But it seemed to us that a lot of us, for example, us in this hall, including me, find it incredibly powerful meditation and sadhana to work with someone that is dying. And there are many people that are dying that need somebody around them that has had enough experience with their sadhana to be cool enough to be present in that space. So we're just going to be like a shutkin, a marriage broker in the Jewish religion. Somebody that arranges these relationships between what are called guides and dyers. And originally just set these up with, and we're working on creating manuals for the guides and little cassette tapes for the bedside for dealing with pain and seminars for the families of the people that are dying so they don't freak the whole scene out and they get the support they need. And ultimately, I would imagine we would have Benarises in the West. We would have scenes where people could come and say, I want to die here, and I would like to die among people that aren't busy denying death or trying to cling to life. And I imagine a person coming to such a dying center would decide which doctor they wanted, how much medication they wanted, what kind of religious metaphor they'd like to die in. You can die in a Christian metaphor, in a Buddhist metaphor, in a Hindu. We can help. All metaphors available. And in addition, you'd have a guide, and the guides would have their families, so there'd be kids there, and there'd be a whole scene, living scene. Because ultimately, like in India, when people die, they die in the home, and everybody's around them. And everybody isn't so freaked, they don't push it under the mat. Okay? Now, if you think all that's very interesting, let me now move to the next stage of our evening, where we work with the slides, and you will see the work you have to do in yourself with regard to this matter of dealing with dying. Okay? Because it isn't quite as easy as it might seem, but it's incredibly powerful stuff. If you will relax and open yourselves, what tormented Ivan Ilyich the most was the deception. They're not wishing to admit what they all knew and what he knew, but they wanted to lie to him and forcing him to participate in that lie. And thus he had to live all alone on the brink of an abyss with no one who understood him or pitied him. In Benares, when somebody dies, they are wrapped in a cloth on a stretcher and carried through the streets with the chanting of Ram's name, quite different from this, which has made it all so antiseptic. The barrier of aloneness of a patient in the late stages of rheumatic heart disease. Each day she entered his room, she felt guilty because she was going to live, while he, a man of her own age, was about to die. I knew he wanted to talk to me, but I always turned it into something light, a little joke, or into some evasive reassurance which had to fail. The patient knew, and I knew. But as he saw my desperate attempts to escape and felt my anxiety, he took pity on me and kept to himself what he wanted to share with another human being. And so he died and didn't bother me. The usual responses in a nurse's diary about the direct question, am I going to die? One, moralizing. You shouldn't talk that way, Mr. Jones. No one knows when he's going to die. Stating facts. I don't think you're going to die today, Mr. Jones. Let me take your pulse. It's strong and steady and your color is good. Direct denial. I don't think you'll die today or even tomorrow. Philosophizing. No one really knows what the future holds. Changing the subject. Who's that in the picture on your nightstand? Referring the patient to another person. I'm unable to tell you that. The doctor is better able to tell you. Hitting the patient. Oh, come on now, you're going to outlive me. Avoiding the question by silence. Mm-hmm. And Krisha Gotami had an only son, and he died. In her grief, she carried the dead child to all her neighbors, asking them for medicine. And the people said, "She has lost her senses. The boy is dead." Krisha Gotami went to the Buddha and cried, "Lord and Master, give me the medicine that will cure my boy." Buddha answered, "I want a handful of mustard seed." And when the girl in her joy promised to procure it, Buddha added, "The mustard seed must be taken from a house where no one has lost a child, husband, parent, or friend." Poor Krisha Gotami now went from house to house, and the people pitied her and said, "Here is mustard seed, take it." But when she asked, "Did a son or daughter, a father or mother die in your family?" they answered her, "Alas, the living are few, but the dead are many. Do not remind us of our deepest grief." And there was no house but some beloved one had died in it. Krisha Gotami became weary and hopeless and sat down at the roadside watching the lights of the city as they flickered up and were extinguished again. At last the darkness of the night reigned everywhere, and she considered the fate of men, that their lives flicker up and are extinguished. And she thought to herself, "How selfish am I in my grief? Death is common to all, yet in this valley of desolation there is a path that leads him who has surrendered all selfishness to immortality." Putting away the selfishness of her affection for her child, Krisha Gotami had the dead body buried in the forest. Returning to Buddha, she took refuge in him and found comfort. Buddha said, "The life of mortals in this world is troubled and brief, for there is not any means by which those that have been born can avoid dying. After reaching old age, there is death. Of such a nature are living beings." The hardest thing is the fear of death, the fear and the pain. Pain of anticipation. For people that are not prepared, that are not conscious, there is confusion, and their minds can't get clear because of the pain and the fear. When you meditate and your legs hurt, your knees hurt, and you learn how to sit with the pain, you're beginning the long journey to dealing with the incredible, unexpected, intense pain that is connected with dying. In our society, what we've done is we have used chemicals to reduce the pain, but they've also reduced the consciousness of the individual. And it becomes more apparent that what is needed is incredible clarity of consciousness at the moment of death. And somebody who can whisper to you, "Right here, stay right here, stay with each moment, be with your own dying. Let go. It's okay. It's all right." The being who's ready to live with the pain live with the pain, a statement of a conscious being. more difficult to deal with the sudden violent deaths, the unexpected. It could happen to anybody in this room at any moment. In this past week here at Naropa, I've dealt with a woman who found out she had malignant cancer on Tuesday of last week, a boy who fell off a mountain, and a girl who was in an automobile accident yesterday in which the man she was with was killed. All unexpected, all shattering, but all being dealt with by conscious beings working with this. Perhaps not Gandhi, who says Ram as he dies, but working on it. Our death is waiting, said Don Juan, and this very act we're performing now may well be our last battle on earth. I call it a battle because it's a struggle. Most people move from act to act without any struggle or thought. He proceeds judiciously, as if every act were his last battle. Only the fool would fail to realize the advantage a hunter has over his fellow men. A hunter gives his last battle its due respect. It's only natural that his last act on earth should be the best of himself. It's pleasurable that way. It dulls the edge of his fright. Use the awareness of your death. Focus your attention on the link between you and your death without remorse, without sadness, without worrying. Focus your attention on the fact you don't have time and let your acts flow accordingly. Let each of your acts be your last battle on earth. Only under those conditions will your acts have their rightful power. Otherwise, they will be, for as long as you live, the acts of a timid person. Is it so terrible to be a timid person, Don Juan? No, it isn't if you're going to be immortal. But if you're going to die, there's no time for timidity. Simply because timidity makes you cling to something that exists only in your thoughts. Sadhana is the preparation that at any moment you are able to let go of the thought of your own existence, no matter how violent or unexpected the moment may be. How does a man of knowledge exercise controlled folly when it comes to the death of a person he loves? I asked. Take your grandson Lucio, I said. Take my son Eulalio. That's a better example, Don Juan replied. He was crushed by rocks while working on the construction of the Pan American Highway. My acts towards him at the moment of his death were controlled folly. When I came down to the blasting area, he was almost dead. But his body was so strong that it kept moving and kicking. I stood in front of him and told the boys and the road crew not to move him anymore. They obeyed me, and we stood there surrounding my son, looking at his mangled body. I stood there too, but I did not look. I shifted my eyes so I would see his personal life disintegrating, expanding uncontrollably beyond its limits, like a fog of crystals, because that is the way life and death mix and expand. That is what I did at the time of my son's death. That's all one could ever do, and that is controlled folly. Had I looked at him, I would have watched him becoming immobile, and I would have felt a cry inside of me, because never again would I look at his fine figure pacing the earth. But I looked at his death instead, and there was no sadness, no feeling. The death was equal to everything else. A man may be born, but in order to be truly born, he must first die. And in order to die, he must first awake. When a man awakens, he can die. And when he dies, he can be born. To awake, to die, to be born. To awaken, to die, to be born.